when you think about 1% in your role and the work that you do as a leader in this business, when you're having to have all these conversations and carry so much in your mind to sort of keep all the plates spinning, what is 1% to you, Christiana? Like, what is it that you do, and how do you bring that into your life to make that a real progression?
I do something that is often kind of the counter to the commonality, and that is I absolutely sweat the small stuff every single day. That's what it means to me. Yeah. And that doesn't just show up in, you know, we spoke about the importance of curiosity and discovery with your clients. I also sweat the small stuff in any type of proposal presentation that we're pulling together. You know, some people would almost think it's obsessive, like, but I absolutely sweat the small stuff. And I think it's one of the takeout questions that you ask people: what's the worst advice you've ever had? And it's don't sweat the small stuff. In my life, in my lived experience, and anything, you know, everything that we're building here, it's essential. Those 1% absolutely compound over time. And Stephen Bartlett and Diary of a CEO is an absolute living embodiment of that. It wasn't until year three that it actually accelerated. And it was the byproduct of those compounding returns of sweating the small stuff. Those 1% show up in your observation of your team as well. So when we talk about the curiosity piece, it is absolutely not just our clients. So when you're observing human behavior and you've picked up on a 1% different, maybe tonation in someone's voice that day, energy, receptiveness in meetings, it's making the time to make sure you're having a conversation because you've observed a potential 1% dip in energy, you know, emotion. We absolutely make time for that. So, you know, it just turns up everywhere all the time, every day, if you saw how observant all of our leaders are as well, not just in the work that they're doing, but in the teams that they're motivating and enabling, because it's also really easy when you're in an environment like ours that you're moving so fast that you forget to connect with people. It's very, very easy. And I think I've seen a lot of leaders in the past maybe fail on that to a degree because they get so transfixed in the immediate deadlines and priorities and work that they need to produce that day that they maybe ignore that 1% observation they made on a team member needing some extra support that particular day. It all sounds so cliche, but it's all comes down to observation as well when we're thinking about those tiny 1%. If you're picking it up on work that you're seeing, the brief that you're reviewing, the curiosity that you're applying with your partners, but also internally with your teams. And our absolute high conviction, this goes back to 1% and how it shows up for me, is that I'm absolutely committed to delayed gratification. And for me, it's really connected. And I know that if I keep turning up in this way, it, you know, kind of links back to saying no to a seemingly incredible deal that, you know, we would have had financial return. No, we're absolutely all committed to this path of delayed gratification because we believe that the bigger, better payoff will be coming, and it won't necessarily be financial. It will be what we've been able to achieve independently together based on our first principles, our cultural journey, and that we're not willing to compromise on those standards or work with partners that don't necessarily uphold our same standards and ideology. So I hope that answers the question, but it's just all connected to me that 1% for me also means, it's just coming to me more now, delayed gratification. I'm willing to wait for the compounding return.
It is a difficult thing, I think, mostly to communicate that to other people when you're leading them or when you're trying to project a level of excellence around people. You know, we have two young girls, not too young anymore, but when they first started at their first day of kindergarten, giant backpacks, huge hats, big dresses. It all looked too oversized. All of us as parents are, of course, freaking out because it's like this is it. Like we're starting at this point. Education sort of kicks off. And the headmaster of the school where our girls went to, a fabulous woman, Dr. Bryony Scott, said, "You have nothing to fear here because they'll only be new on their first day." And we thought, oh, what a lovely thing to say. Quite a bravado-filled statement, because what followed after that was, you know, I'm here running a feminist boot camp, so they're going to be fine. But the reality was on day two, they came home that night and I really wanted to test, you know, and this is somebody who is 6 years old, right? I wanted to test and see, well, how new do you feel? Like, is it new? And then the next day they went into school. Now, I don't know what happened between day one and day two, but there was something of familiarity that made them feel completely comfortable, but challenged at the same time. When I dived into this over the years to understand that more from the teaching staff involved, it was very obvious to me that, yes, they had a 1% mentality to improve, but they had a basis for excellence that was not necessarily articulated. It wasn't on walls. It wasn't, you know, part of a deck that you received. It was more about the fact that they were just there to pursue excellence. And when there was somebody having an off day, they would feel bad because they weren't able to achieve that level of excellence, but the person next to them stepped in to make sure that as a unit, they delivered excellence. And, you know, this is all before COVID, then COVID came, and for some reason that still persevered. And I think when you look at people who are trying to lead and have so much change and so much disruption going on, all I think you can really ask of people is to be excellent. And there's something about the term, I think, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, that it is not, it's not charged, right? Like, there is not a, it's not a loaded term. Mm. But if somebody says, well, you know, are you being excellent at this task, and you're not, or your level of excellence is something different, then you can have a discussion, which I think can be quite a rich discussion, as opposed to one that's around performance or contribution. And again, I say that because, you know, I remember seeing the preparation that went into the Boris Johnson interview. I don't know who the research team was, but I remember seeing a photo of the book, and this is Boris Johnson, former UK Prime Minister, that he'd written a book, which was his version of events, which I'm pretty sure most of the world didn't really concur with. And inside that book was more post-it notes and more, like, I've never seen a book that's been that heavily annotated and marked before. And I know that Stephen's conversation with him was a deeply uncomfortable one. He mentioned it before, he mentioned it afterwards. But it was still grossly educational for anyone who decided to sort of go through it. So I guess it's just a long way of saying that even when things are difficult, there's a level of excellence which still seems to persevere across the culture at Flight Story.
I love everything you said with the word that excellence isn't as maybe emotionally loaded as high performance. You're right. High performance is almost linked to maybe some of the potentials that it's less humane or something, whereas the pursuit of excellence. I mean, yes,
and I have to give that to my friend Ryan Hawke. Like, this is not my language. This is his language, and it's fantastic. And he's built his career around that principle, and it's something else. It's why he has 650 podcast episodes, and he talks to extraordinary leaders around the world. So I don't want to put that to one side, but it's a very important one, I think.
I mean, absolutely. I need to get more familiar with his work because it's absolutely resonating with me. You know, we almost take it for granted but of course there's a million post-it notes in the book from the research team. I'm not even remotely surprised to hear that. You know, it just is at Flight Story. And
it just is. That's nice.
It just, yeah. Which is, I mean, we don't get me wrong. We have a gratitude channel and we have a channel that celebrates the 1%. And when you talk about our kind of cadences and rituals, that's a really big important one for us. So someone in the team, for example, it wouldn't be unusual for someone to see that book on Jem's desk or whoever was responsible for that particular research brief, take a photo of it and put it in our 1% channel and celebrate the thoroughness and the excellence that went into prepping that research brief. Mm-hmm. So when I say it just is, it's not that it's not recognized. It's just that it's every day, it's always, and then there's this beautiful feedback loop. If I showed you our 1% channel, the things that get celebrated, a great example is when Jem changed the candles in the DOAC studio for a different scent based on research of that particular guest. Maybe her favorite scent was like lavender or something. And she shared that she has run a new experiment of swapping out the candles, and the entire team like erupts with love and applause and adoration because, you know, yes, it just is, but also, yes, we celebrate it every single day. And I think that's the virtuous cycle. It wouldn't be just is if we weren't also celebrating it. But this channel, people would think we're crazy. We celebrate tiny, tiny, tiny incremental improvements. We moved a couch from left hand side of the office to the right hand side of the office, more for like a feng shui piece that we felt that it wasn't like a great pathway when people are walking between A to B. Total celebration and eruption in the channel from Harry, our head of happiness, from doing a seemingly small thing. And it's all connected to the core principles of why Diary of a CEO and all of our new shows are growing at such a rapid pace, because we obsess over the 1%. And we believe that it's not just the compounding rate of returns over time, again, classic Warren Buffett analogy, it's the culture that we've cultivated in celebrating that that almost propels and continues to fuel everyone forward. It's really fascinating of something seemingly, those things that are easy to do are also easy not to do. So a lot of people don't bother doing it.
I look, people will listen to this episode and I think people are going to listen to this and just go, so that sounds great. Our culture is a long way from that in our organization. And I would ask anyone who is thinking that to just go, well, what if it didn't have to be that way? Because like you said, there were years in the making where Flight Story of the Diary, there wasn't really much, right? Yep. And the irony about most companies that tend to scale well is that there wasn't much in the beginning. Right. But the culture is the one thing that drives it. And when you think about your business development capability, your partnerships capability, there is a lot to be had by the curiosity, by the ruthlessness into trying to understand what's in it for you and delivering on that. So with all that said and done, we're going to get to rapid fire in a second.
Okay.
There is one question that is in the front of my mind. Because you and I know partnerships pretty well, right? We've been doing this for a while now. We know the questions to ask. We know why people do and don't do deals. We know why the deals fall over. What do you think people are missing about the value of partnerships in business?
It goes back to what I said earlier, which, you know, on one hand, I'm trying to be really mindful of the people listening to this because it sounds so simple. But what people are missing is that a partnership should serve to be mutually beneficial and deliver real business results for both parties. And if it doesn't deliver that, it won't scale, it won't be meaningful, it won't return to repeat business. And I think people get really caught up in trying to this kind of obsession with short-termism or the opposite of delayed gratification. That they're trying to do something out of, let's say, financial pressures for today or more of a tactical decision versus understanding if I have more of a two-year business plan focus and if I am prepared to say no to certain things that I don't think are going to be mutually beneficial and not the right fit, well, that's ultimately going to free up my time and energy to focus and be much more thoughtful and intentional on finding the right fit. And again, I think I said it last week that people tend to overcomplicate it. Stick to your first principles consistently over time and you will absolutely scale and be successful. It all depends on how, I suppose, much you're willing to wait, what your objectives are. Are you seeking to have a short-term financial gain or are you seeking to build a long-term career where you feel fulfilled and passionate, that has longevity, you know, cross markets, cross companies, cross teams? And it gets overlooked, and particularly in traditional sales, there's a lot more like celebration of getting a deal or negotiating the best possible price where you've really, really driven it to the bottom or tried to kind of hold. Yeah, it's just a short-term versus long-term approach. Look at Stephen Bartlett, the Diary of a CEO. He is celebrated on Forbes list, Times top 100 creators. He's now, you know, that classic case of seemingly, you know, an overnight success. No, he started the podcast 7 years ago and it wasn't until year three that he started meaningfully distributing on YouTube that he got any traction. So for 3 years consistently, he was still showing up in the same way and having that lens of delayed gratification. And I keep coming back to it, but I think it is really important because if you have a long-term view when you're speaking to your clients, it completely changes your behavior.
Yeah.
If something's not working, you want to address it straight away and optimize it, because you're thinking about next year's partnership, the renewal. You're not thinking about, I just need to deliver this deal today, now, to deliver said quota, and then I'll move on to the next. It like fundamentally changes your perspective if you are committed to that delayed gratification. But equally, it's up to leadership and the organization to design their incentives in such a way. So it's like a much bigger kind of systemic problem that I think Simon Sinek speaks to as well in his Infinite Mindset book, where he speaks to how broken the current kind of global incentives are, that every kind of CEO that runs a publicly listed company, they are legally and contractually obligated to maximize the share price today, even though it may have massive detrimental impact for year 3, year 4, year 5. So I also want to respect everyone that it's not easy. There's a lot of systemic forces that are against us in terms of the way companies are structured and incentives are structured. So I would say any kind of leader and anyone that has the ability to impact meaningful change, or founders on this call, to get really clear about setting up your organization and your incentives in a way that rewards the right behaviors, that rewards longevity.